Welcome to Atlas Apollia. This is Aleko, and all glory is due to Christ. So as I've alluded to several times, I really wanted to discuss some of the folks that I saw at the Cambridge Apologetics Conference. Some of them were, as I've said multiple times now, absolutely fascinating. But one in particular really got my attention, and it wasn't surprisingly the one that I thought it would be. It was a gentleman by the name of Peter J. Williams, who is a New Testament historian. And he's written a couple of books that I know of, based on the talk that he gave at the Cambridge Apologetics Conference, I was absolutely blown away because he brought a level of textual criticism to the table that I frankly wasn't aware of. And almost everything that he said was new and quite novel to me. In other words, I had never heard it before. I never heard anyone talk about some of the things that he has gleaned and discovered from the New Testament. And it was exciting, and it was fresh, and it was, you know, stuff that I think really should be put out in the ether. So the first thing I'll do is I'll encourage you to go out and get his work. And his name, again, is Peter J. Williams. It's Dr. Peter J. Williams, rather. The book that I would recommend that I have read at least half of so far is... Allow me to pull up my book here. Let's see. I'm opening my phone. Now, I've got Paul by N.T. Wright open here, because that is going to be our next book club book. So if you want to join our book club, by the way, go out and get that. But, yes, it's Can We Trust the Gospels by Peter J. Williams. And I know that, again, he has another book, at least one other book, but Can We Trust the Gospels? It is going to blow your mind. And I've got some information here that I want to share from that, and maybe you can take it and share it elsewhere as well. So in it, he essentially argues for the reliability of the Gospels, and that's something we've talked about a lot at very great length on this podcast and in my audiobook. Christ as a historical figure is one of the most confirmable characters in antiquity, if not the most confirmable character in antiquity. And this is stuff that many people have probably heard before, but it, you know, for all the obvious reasons, humans are comparative learners. And if we do a comparative analysis of people who are touted as historical figures, like, for example, Alexander the Great or Buddha, the amount of information that's out there regarding those figures is quite sparse when compared to Christ. So for example, I think, and again, I'm always pulling from memory, but hopefully getting better at it. For Buddha, it's the two historians who wrote about Buddha were Lumbini and Shakya, and I know I'm butchering those names, but they didn't write until, I think, 400 to 600 years after he lived. And the same thing for Alexander the Great. The two historians who wrote about him were Arrian and Plutarch, I believe, and again, in the same ballpark, 400 to 600 years after he lived, the first things were written about him. Now, that doesn't fly in the face of, you know, the ancient method of history keeping, which was oral, of course. You know, people basically told their history, you know, to a group of people, and believe it or not, memory was much better back then. Some groups of ancient Greeks wouldn't get out of bed until they could recite everything they had learned the previous day. And you know, there's a lot of really interesting memory practices from antiquity that, you know, would just blow our minds nowadays because it's just stuff that we don't do anymore. But memory was quite good, and you had society as a means of preserving truths. So, for example, if one person got something wrong, you would have three other people who would then recall the story and correct them. And you know, things like tablets were kept, and you also have things like archaeology, you have pottery, where people would preserve images to sort of pass along history. And you also had things like city names, like, you know, Alexander the Great had many cities named after him. And, you know, the spread of the Greek language was due to him, which was a sort of corroboration of his life. So we know that oral history was quite good, and it's very likely that Alexander the Great was a real person. Buddha, however, I think it's a lot more scarce, and It's very likely because he was a pseudo-religious figure. And for those of you who think Buddhism is just a philosophy, I lived in Asia for about a decade. I can tell you firsthand, it very much is a religion. Many people deify Buddha and think of him as a god, believe it or not. And because of that, a lot of what was written about Buddha could have fallen to legend, and I believe very well did. And the same thing goes for Zoroastrianism, which many people claim is the first monotheistic religion. They claim that it's even 1,000 years older than Christianity, but quite frankly, the Parsi biography was written 1,000 years after Christ. So Gothis of Zoroaster supposedly existed 2,000 years after the first history was written about him. And, you know, legend can set in, and it becomes much less of a credible document when that much time has passed and that much oral history was used, because it's not quite the telephone game with antiquity, as a lot of people think, and people's, you know, looking at it as the telephone game, as many people often choose to, is quite frankly looking at ancient history through a peephole, a societal peephole, a modern societal peephole, rather, and applying our standards of today to things that were going on thousands of years ago. And that's not really the right way to do things, because we're not the same people. We're very, very different people because of our practices and our diets and our education. And quite frankly, I think that, you know, people back then, oftentimes when they were educated, were exponentially more educated than some of the folks you might find today. And perhaps the width and the breadth of knowledge is why, you know, there's a wider base of knowledge today, but in terms of capability, for example, in terms of mathematics, writing, reading, and memorization, and maybe even overall problem solving, and I know I'm extending a bit here, might have been better in antiquity, especially at the time of the Romans, the Greeks, the ancient Jews, the ancient Israelites, the Chinese, and possibly the Egyptians as well as the Babylonians, all had tremendous practice with the educated class of society. And that doesn't, you know, we're not forgetting that there were peasants back then who were probably not that well educated, but for those who were in the know, they probably were very well stimulated with the practice of the time. So all of that aside, we've covered a number of reasons why the New Testament is very viable. And, you know, we just basically stated that oral history and some very, very few written records were kept of some of the most famous figures from history. But when you look at the New Testament, there's just a cornucopia of evidence. Liberal scholars put the first epistles written about Christ to within 1 year of his resurrection. Some of the Gospels, all of them within at least 10 years, possibly sooner, and definitely no later than AD 70, because there is no mention of the crucifixion, or sorry, the martyrdom, or rather crucifixion of Peter, as well as the destruction of the Jerusalem temple and a number of other things. So very, very recent in terms of when they were written from the time of the resurrection and crucifixion of Christ. A veritable heartbeat. And then you have a number of other historians, most of which were either indifferent or didn't like Christians, corroborating some of the biggest parts of the story. So all of that, again, we've covered before, but Peter J. Williams takes it 10 steps further. He does cover some familiar territory, and I'll maybe cover that in a second here. So in essence, he discusses the corroboration by external sources like Tacitus and the detailed knowledge of Jewish customs and names. He emphasizes the Gospels' intimate knowledge of the region, cultural practices, and use of common names with what we call disambiguators, and I'll get into that in a second, indicate their authenticity as well. And disambiguators was an interesting one. Williams explains that faith, often seen as non-rational, is actually based on trust and evidence. He points out that the Gospels provide substantial evidence for their reliability, challenging the notion that belief in their accounts is without foundation. So let's get into the external corroboration part, because that's something we've touched on many times on this podcast, but it's still an interesting one, and I think it's very important, because you know, again, one of the biggest straw man arguments against the Gospels is that it's just a group of friends who decided to try to get quote unquote famous by writing about a new religious figure that was supposedly fake, but they made him out to be real so they could gain some type of notoriety. Though that's been proven to be absolutely false because, you know, many of the people who wrote about Christ, or at least people tethered to them, were martyred. Skeptics often argue that the Gospels are unreliable because their authors had an agenda to promote a specific message. Williams counters this by highlighting that within 90 years of the Gospels' composition, hostile sources like Pliny the Younger and Tacitus confirmed major portions of their narratives. Tacitus, renowned for his meticulousness and insightful historical accounts, provides external validation for many Gospel events, including the crucifixion of Christ during the rule of Tiberius and Pontius Pilate. Tacitus's credibility is bolstered by his accurate descriptions of places and events he never witnessed personally, but which have been corroborated by other sources. For instance, Tacitus wrote about the Great Fire in Rome and how Emperor Nero blamed Christians for the disaster, though it was likely Nero's own doing. Tacitus also noted the rapid spread of Christianity and the dangerous consequences of being a Christian at the time. Williams points out that Tacitus's writings, given their accuracy and the time period in which he wrote, provide strong external support for the historical claims made by the Gospels. The same goes for Pliny the Younger, another Roman historian, who also provides external evidence supporting the Gospels. In his letters to the Emperor Trajan, Pliny describes the early Christians' worship practices and how Christians were persecuted for their beliefs. These accounts, written independently of the Christian texts, corroborate the existence and rapid growth of the Christian community as well as the centrality of Christ in worship. Josephus, a Jewish historian, also provides corroboration, despite his complex relationship with the early Christian community. Josephus's writings include references to Jesus, John the Baptist, and James, the brother of Jesus. While some scholars debate the authenticity of certain passages, particularly the Testimonium Flavinium, the majority agree that Josephus provides valuable external evidence for the historical existence of Christ and the early Christian movement. And just a quick aside here, my only criticism of Peter J. Williams' book, Can We Trust the Gospels, is that he doesn't go further and mention some of the other incredible accounts, outside accounts of the Gospels, or rather outside corroborations of the Gospels. But that's about it. You know, he takes it another direction, and that's perfectly fine. But because of his thoroughness, I kind of hoped he would have gone a little bit further. So Williams emphasized the importance of having four Gospels, noting that multiple accounts of a historical figure were rare in antiquity, as we've mentioned many times before. The Gospels were widely recognized by the 2nd and 3rd centuries, with the early manuscripts like Papyrus 45 and acknowledgments by early Christian figures such as Irenaeus and Tatian, indicating their early acceptance and credibility. Irenaeus, for example, acknowledged the fourfold nature of the Gospels, and Tatian created a harmony of the four Gospels, demonstrating their established recognition at the time. And to put this from another perspective, essentially, historians of the time knew that there were only four Gospels and were discussing only four Gospels. So for all the folks that try to suggest that there were other Gospels, and it's quite sexy or interesting to proclaim, you know, other false Gospels like the Gospel of Thomas, these are early indicators that at the time the only ones in circulation were the four that we knew of the Bible, and that the other ones were written much later. And I might touch on that a little bit more in a second here, but we have touched on that in this particular podcast. You know, the four Gospels were the authentic ones, as much as other people tend to suggest that there are other narratives of Christ that are just being covered up by the church or something like that. It's completely false, and it's very easily provably false, I should say. So Williams argues that the existence of the four Gospels is a banquet of information for historians, compared to the single or double accounts typical for other historical figures, as I mentioned earlier. He contrasts this with the later apocryphal gospels, or rather the false gospels, which were not recognized or circulated until much later and are often filled with anachronistic details that do not align with the historical and cultural contexts of Jesus' time. So in other words, a lot of the false gospels, they very clearly didn't know a lot about Jewish customs, which means they were written by non-Jews, and they didn't know anything about the region. They weren't able to really speak to specific details the way the four gospels were, which is an indicator that they were written by people not from that time, not from that region, and not tethered to anyone from that region. So an example of this would be Luke is the only person, only writer of the Gospels who is believed to be non-Jewish. He was very likely Greek, and he worked with Paul. And he was able to express in tremendous details some of the things that were going on around the area that Christ walked. And this is very likely because Paul was his dictator, right? He was the one that was dictating all of the information. And it was also corroborated by Peter, as Paul notes later on in his epistles. So he worked personally with the people who knew Christ personally, who walked hand in hand with Christ during the time of the Gospels. But the later false Gospels very clearly did not know anything about the region, nor did they have anyone to explain little idiosyncrasies of the region to them. So the presence of multiple independent accounts adds a layer of credibility that a single account often lacks. So, for example, the Synoptic Gospels, like Matthew, Mark, and Luke, share a significant amount of material, but also include unique details and perspectives, while the Gospel of John provides a different yet complementary account of Jesus' life and teachings. This multiplicity of sources allows for cross-verification and a richer, more nuanced understanding of the historical figure of Jesus. So, the Gospels are praised for their geographical and cultural accuracy, as I've just mentioned. They mention 26 towns accurately, understand the topography of ancient Israel, and include details that would be difficult to fabricate without an intimate knowledge of the region. So Williams contrasts this with the apocryphal Gospels, as I just mentioned, which lack such detailed geographical and cultural information. The Gospels' authors demonstrate a deep familiarity with the region, mentioning both well-known cities like Jerusalem and small villages like Bethany. This level of detail suggests that the authors had direct or closely informed knowledge of the area, as I just said. So Williams notes that the Gospels also understand logistics of how cities related to bodies of water, such as the Sea of Galilee, which is consistently referred to as simply the sea by the authors. He points out that Luke, who was not from the region, refers to it as a lake, indicating his different perspective and supporting the notion that the gospel writers had authentic knowledge of their respective locations. So this very, very likely means Luke was from somewhere near the Mediterranean, which was a massive body of water when compared to the Sea of Galilee, which was only several miles across. The people who were from around the Sea of Galilee thought it was pretty big, and they referred to it as the sea. But Luke clearly thought it was more like the size of a lake, and thus called it a lake. Moreover, the Gospels accurately describe travel routes and times, distances between locations, and even elevation differences between cities, such as the descent from Jerusalem to Jericho. These geographical details add the credibility to the Gospel accounts. For example, the parable of the Good Samaritan in Luke's Gospel mentions the treacherous road from Jerusalem to Jericho, a detail that aligns with the historical and geographical knowledge of the area. The Gospels also capture the social and political landscape of the time. They reflect the tension between the Jewish and Roman authorities, as well as the various Jewish sects, such as the Pharisees and the Sadducees. This nuanced portrayal of the socio-political context adds to the historical credibility of the Gospels. Use of names in the Gospels are consistent with those popular in the region and time, often using what we called disambiguators to specify individuals with common names. So this attention to detail further supports their authenticity. So a disambiguator would be like, for example, Simon the Zealot or Mary Magdalene, which we'll get to in a second. In contrast, the apocryphal Gospels do not show such familiarity with the names and customs of the time. The Gospels authors knew which names were common and used specific identifiers to distinguish between individuals with the same name, reflecting an intimate knowledge of the cultural context. Williams underscores that the use of disambiguators, like Simon the Zealot or Mary Magdalene, shows the disambiguator, for clarity, would be the Zealot or Magdalene. And this shows that the Gospel writers were aware of the naming conventions and common names of the time. This level of detail is absent in later apocryphal writings, which often lack such precise cultural and historical context. So additionally, the Gospels reflect the frequency of certain names, such as Simon, Mary, and Joseph, which aligns with the historical records of Jewish names from that period. This consistency with known naming patterns further supports the authenticity of Gospel accounts. And for clarity, I'll just backtrack and say that disambiguators typically were the town that the person was from, their career, so Simon the Zealot, the type of thing that they did. And there were other disambiguators, but very rarely, unless the person was very rich, they have a quote-unquote surname or last name or family name, right? They just use a disambiguator. And this is also an indicator that these names, as I just said, they occurred over and over again. So, you know, just like today in whatever region you're from, I would say especially in North America, there are names that are very popular for specific amounts of time, typically only for, you know, 10, maybe 15 years, and then they'll kind of fade out and then other names will take their place. The same was very true of the time of Christ. You had names that were very popular for a brief period of time, so much so that people had to use disambiguators so you knew which Simon people were talking about. You knew which Mary people were talking about. There are even tombs that exist of Jesus's, Mary's, and Joseph's to show how common the name was from those names were from the time. So they had disambiguators like Jesus of Nazareth or Jesus the Nazarene, as he was commonly known, to identify who people were talking about. So finally, Williams underscores the Jewishness of the Gospels, noting that they reflect Jewish cultures, traditions, Jewish culture, tradition, and religious thought, which is not seen in the apocryphal texts. So this deep understanding of Jewish customs and context further strengthens the argument for the historical reliability of the canonical Gospels. The Gospels authors demonstrate a thorough understanding of Jewish ritual, debates, and cultural practices, indicating their close connection to the Jewish world of the time. So, for example, the Gospels contained detailed discussions on Jewish laws concerning purity, forgiveness of sins, and the Sabbath observance. John mentions specific Jewish purification rituals and places like Solomon's Colonnade, which would have only been known to someone familiar with the Jewish customs before the destruction of the Jerusalem temple in AD 70. So another indicator that the Gospels were written before AD 70 and very close to the life of Christ is that Luke, although a Gentile, records Jesus' last words that reflect a Jewish prayer, showing his understanding of Jewish culture through his association with Paul. The Gospels also capture the essence of Jewish theological debates, such as those regarding who has authority to forgive sins, which was a focal point of Jewish religious thought. Jesus' interactions with the Pharisees and Sadducees, as well as his teachings on the kingdom, are deeply rooted in Jewish eschatological expectations. The Gospels reflect Jewish festivals and customs in detail. For example, John's account of the Festival of Tabernacle, the Sukkot, includes specific references to the rituals and symbols associated with the festival, such as the water pouring ceremony. This level of detail indicates a deep familiarity with Jewish religious practices. And then Williams contrasts the detailed and accurate information found in the canonical Gospels with the deficiencies of the later false Gospels, or rather apocryphal texts. He points out that the apocryphal Gospels, written centuries after the canonical ones, lack geographical, as mentioned before, cultural and historical precision. For example, the Gospel of Thomas mentions Judea only once and names no other geographic location, while the Gospel of Judas names no known locations at all. The Gospel of Philip names Jerusalem four times, Nazareth with an alternate spelling, and Jordan once. Those were common places that anyone from the region might have known about, and not specific as the Gospels were. This starkly contrasts with the true canonical Gospels, which mentions a wide array of locations and precise details. The apocryphal texts also fail to exhibit the same level of familiarity with Jewish customs and names. They lack the use of disambiguators, as mentioned before, and do not reflect the common naming conventions of the time. This absence of detail and contextual accuracy suggests that the authors were not as intimately familiar with the setting and region as well as the culture of Jesus' time. Moreover, the theological and philosophical content of the apocryphal texts often diverge significantly from the Jewish context of the canonical Gospels. For instance, the Gospel of Thomas contains sayings of Jesus that are more in line with Gnostic beliefs than with Jewish traditions and teachings found in the New Testament. There are also undesigned coincidences. Williams points out that the concept of undesigned coincidences as further evidence of the Gospel's reliability pop up throughout the writings. These are incidental details mentioned in passing that align with other independent accounts, providing mutual reinforcement without any apparent intention of collusion. For example, in John's Gospel, Jesus asks Philip to buy bread to feed the crowd, and in another Gospel, it's mentioned that Philip was from Bethsaida, a detail that makes sense of why Jesus would ask him specifically. Such coincidences suggest that the accounts are based on genuine historical events rather than being fabricated stories. Another example of an undesigned coincidence is found in the accounts of Jesus feeding the 5,000. In John's Gospel, it is noted that there was much grass in the place, indicating a springtime setting. In Mark's account, the people sat down in groups on the green grass. These independent details align and reinforce the historical credibility of the event. Williams also emphasizes the significance of eyewitness testimony in the Gospels. The authors of the Gospels either were eyewitnesses themselves or had access to firsthand accounts from those who were. For instance, the Gospel of John explicitly claims to be based on the testimony of the disciple whom Jesus loved, traditionally identified as John himself. The Gospel of Luke begins with a prologue stating that the author carefully investigated everything from the beginning and based his account on the testimonies of eyewitnesses. The presence of eyewitness testimony adds a layer of credibility to the Gospels. Eyewitnesses would have been able to provide accurate and detailed accounts of events they personally experienced, reducing the likelihood of embellishment or fabrication. He also notes that there is textual evidence supporting the reliability of the Gospels. The sheer number of manuscript copies of the Gospels compared to other ancient texts is remarkable. There are thousands of Greek manuscripts, and if I think back to it, I think I'm trying to remember the historian, but in Lee Strobel's book, The Case for Christ, which I read a decade ago, he suggests that there are over 5,000 manuscripts, and the next closest text is Homer's Iliad, which is something like 2,500. So there were a ton of them. And there are numerous translations into other languages, such as Latin, Coptic, and Syriac. And this extensive manuscript evidence allows scholars to reconstruct the original texts with a high degree of confidence. Furthermore, the time gap between the original composition of the Gospels and the earliest surviving manuscripts is relatively short compared to other ancient texts. For example, the earliest fragments of the Gospel of John date to around AD 125, within a few decades of its original composition. This short time gap reduces the likelihood of significant textual corruption. He also points out the archaeological discoveries that support the historical reliability of the Gospels. Numerous archaeological findings have corroborated the geographical and cultural details described in the Gospels. For example, the Pool of Bethesda, mentioned in the Gospel of John, was long thought to be a fictional location, until it was discovered in Jerusalem in the 19th century. Similarly, the discovery of the remains of the first century fishing boat in the Sea of Galilee aligns with the description of fishing practices in the Gospels. Archaeological evidence also supports the existence of key figures mentioned in the Gospels. The inscription bearing the name of Pontius Pilate, discovered in Caesarea Maritima, confirms the historical evidence of the Roman governor who played a crucial role in the trial and crucifixion of Christ. So in conclusion, Williams provides a multifaceted argument for the reliability of the Gospels by highlighting their corroboration by external sources, geographical and cultural accuracy, as well as precise use of names, deep Jewish context, and the presence of undesigned coincidences. He presents a compelling case that the Gospels are credible historical documents. He contrasts these features with the deficiencies of the later fake, or rather apocryphal, texts, reinforcing the unique reliability of the canonical, or rather real, Gospels. Williams' analysis suggests that the Gospels, far from being mere religious propaganda, are rooted in history, reality, and provide trustworthy accounts of the life and teachings of Jesus Christ. So his work encourages readers to approach the Gospels not just as religious texts, but as historical documents that withstand rigorous, and I mean very rigorous, scrutiny. The detailed knowledge of geography, culture, and customs, along with external validation from independent sources, makes a strong case for the authenticity and reliability of the Gospels. So I would highly recommend that you go out and get his work, Can We Trust the Gospels? I've only read about halfway through it, but so far it has just absolutely blown my mind, and I'm looking forward to sharing more details with you soon. With all that said, I hope that you've gleaned something from this, and I hope that you're able to share with others, as this is some tremendous stuff. Thanks so much, and God bless.